From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. The United States is the dominant world power, but it may not be for long. That's the subject of the new book, The End of the American Era. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Arthur Charles Kupchan, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, about why he thinks U.S. unilateralism and the strength of the European Union could change the balance. Also, we meet British television personality Ruby Wax. She wrote for the hit comedy series Absolutely Fabulous. She has a new memoir. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the reissue of Joe and Zoot and More, which teamed up violinist Joe Venuti and saxophonist Zoot Sims. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Congress has begun its post-election lame duck session. President Bush has called on lawmakers to pass his first priority, a bill creating a new Department of Homeland Security. The White House has reached a compromise on the measure with key Senate members who say the legislation has to protect the right of federal employees. The House could consider the compromise plan as early as tomorrow, and the Senate could take it up later in the week. Lawmakers must also extend funding to keep the government running because of the funding bills that have been left unfinished from the last session. Tomorrow, congressional Republicans will hold elections for leadership posts in both the House and Senate. Texas Congressman Tom DeLay is unopposed to become the new House Majority Leader. A new short-term member of the Senate was sworn in today at the beginning of the session. Independent Dean Barkley was appointed by Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura to serve the remaining 2 months of the late Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone's term. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
By refusing to align with the Senate's 49 Republicans, Barkley has kept Democrats in control of a chamber where the GOP will soon be the majority. In his first floor speech, Barkley vowed to carry on Wellstone's work.
I plan to continue the fight, my short time here, on one of Paul's signature issues, mental health parity.
Barkley was Minnesota's planning director under Governor Ventura. He also operated a car wash business. A one-time Democrat, Barkley had previously run for the Senate as an independent. Republican leader Trent Lott, who'd hoped Barkley would sit with his caucus, offered the newest senator a helping hand.
So we're looking forward to the opportunity to encourage him, answer his questions, and to work with him.
Republicans hope Barkley will vote with them to approve a White House-backed version of the Homeland Security Department bill. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The cleanup continues in several states hit by tornadoes over the weekend. Ohio is one of them. Bill Cohen reports from Ohio Public Radio.
Officials of the Red Cross say Sunday's tornadoes damaged more than 1,000 houses and businesses, and that includes 141 that were destroyed. Officials have yet to put a dollar figure on the damage. That is more likely to come after Wednesday, when assessment teams from the federal government inspect four counties in northwest Ohio that were the hardest hit. Five people died in the twisters here. Weather experts believe some of the tornadoes had winds of at least 200 miles an hour. 17 of Ohio's 88 counties suffered property damage. Among those helping clean up the debris left by the storms are members of the Ohio National Guard. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 27 points to close at 8,386 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 30 to close at 1,349. This is NPR News. The Federal Reserve's second in command said the central bank's interest rate cut last week should ensure a sustained recovery, but the Fed will need to remain on guard against further bouts of economic weakness. Steve Beckner has more from Market News International.
Fed Vice Chairman Roger Ferguson said that with the Fed's half percentage point rate cut last week, the pieces are in place to engender a gradual strengthening in economic activity. Not only is monetary policy providing considerable support to the economy, he said, but fiscal policy remains conducive to growth. Ferguson said concern about war with Iraq and other risks are causing uncertainty among businesses and households, but said those sources of weakness should begin to disappear. He said deflation, a general decline in price levels that could cause the economy to stagnate, is a remote threat, but said the Fed is prepared to act decisively to make sure that does not happen, and said the Fed must remain watchful for fresh signs of weakness. Greenspan will testify before Congress tomorrow on the economic outlook. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Security's been heightened at many European ports after a warning about a possible terrorist attack this past weekend. Authorities are being particularly cautious about the possibility of a truck bomb being brought aboard one of the region's major ferry boats. British officials say they've started questioning drivers and conducting random searches of trucks at ferry ports. Last week, Dutch police reportedly got a warning saying that a terrorist attack might be planned for November 9th, which was said to have added significance because the date was the reverse of 9/11. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 7 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and WorldCom. An update on management and policy is available at worldcom.com/update.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. It's a generally accepted fact that the United States, despite the threat of terrorism, despite the shaky economy, is still very much the world's leading superpower. And that's a guiding principle of much of the Bush administration's foreign policy, its pursuit of disarming Iraq, the retreat from such international treaties as the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. The underlying assumption is that, in the end, the U.S. can go it alone because it is simply so powerful. Charles Kupchan says this assumption is woefully off the mark. Kupchan is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international relations at Georgetown University. He served as a director for European affairs on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration. In his new book, The End of the American Era, he argues that the United States is far more vulnerable than it appears, and that the rising challenger to its dominance is the European Union. I asked Charles Kupchan what he thinks of the conventional wisdom that the United States is the world's dominant superpower.
I agree with those who claim that the United States today is still dominant, still in a position of military and economic supremacy. Where I cut against the conventional wisdom is on the durability of American dominance, how long it's going to last. And there I think people are just taking a snapshot of the world today and not looking at deeper trends beneath the surface, such as the rise of an amalgamated Europe that can challenge the United States, and a potential change in American politics away from the activist and robust internationalism of the past 50 years to something that could become more diffident, more difficult, perhaps a turning inward.
So does that mean we're looking at the wrong standards, that we spend more on defense than the world's other major superpowers combined, that our economy is twice the size of Japan's? Those aren't the standards that one should judge our power by?
Well, I think that military power only gets you so much. And the fact that the United States spends more than the rest of the great powers combined on defense does mean that we will remain militarily dominant for decades to come. But I think that most people tend to compare the U.S. to other countries, to Japan, to China, to Germany. And there, the U.S. is miles ahead, and nobody has a chance of catching us anytime soon. But where I think the mistake is in failing to appreciate how revolutionary the process of integration is in Europe, that Europe is going through a process quite similar to the one the United States went through in the 19th century. We started with a constitution, and then we began to knit together our separate states. The Europeans started by taking little steps, knitting together their separate states through a coal and steel community, through a common market. And lo and behold, they now have a single market, a single currency, and there is a constitutional convention underway as we speak. And so I think what's happening is Europe is amassing its capability. It is emerging with a GDP almost equal to that of the United States. It will not challenge us militarily, but it is already becoming a political and a diplomatic counterweight.
Now, you argue that as Europe's power grows, its relationship with the U.S. will become increasingly antagonistic on many levels. And clearly, the Bush administration has alienated European nations with its foreign policy on Iraq and its unilateralism. Is that what you're talking about? Are we headed for a clash on the question of statecraft?
Well, I think there are two different dynamics that are taking place. One of them is simply the balance of power, realpolitik. And that is that as we shift from a world with only one center of power to a world with 1.5 or 2 centers of power, of necessity, a certain amount of competition will kick in, simply because of human nature, the desire for influence, prestige, primacy. Competition of that sort has been absent from the landscape because no one can come after the United States. There's no challenger. I think that as the EU comes of age, as the EU begins to take a more collective stand on issues, it will of necessity set its weight against the United States, and therefore a certain amount of competition is inevitable. I think the question is, will competition that is healthy turn into competition that is adversarial in nature? And that's where U.S. behavior is so important, because the United States, since the Bush team has come to power, has been quite unilateralist, quite dismissive of the Kyoto Protocol, the International Criminal Court, the EU's desire to begin to assume more responsibility for its own defense. And in that sense, the Bush administration has alienated Europe. I think it speaks volumes that the Chancellor of Germany, a country that has been a close ally of the U.S. for decades, runs for re-election on an anti-American platform and wins. That's just the tip of the iceberg, I think, and the potential for the EU and the United States to part ways in ways that could have major consequences, not just for the Atlantic relationship, but for the global landscape.
What do you think of the Bush administration's pursuit so far of the struggle against terrorism? What's on the mark and what's troubling to you as you look ahead to our position in the world in the future?
I think the Bush administration has done a reasonably good job in the battle against terror if we look at the tactical level. The attack in Afghanistan against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, the effort to cooperate more fully on law enforcement and on tracking funding for terrorist groups. And they're beginning to make necessary changes here at home in terms of homeland security. If one, however, moves to the strategic level, the big picture, I give the Bush administration much lower marks. And that's because I think that for President Bush and those around him, they think that the terror attacks of September 11 have changed the world, that terrorism is the new entity that defines the geopolitical landscape and where fault lines fall on that landscape. And that's why I think you are seeing them pursue the war on terror with such fixation. In my mind, that is a mistake. I think the world has changed less than the Bush team thinks. There is still an agenda out there that has to do with great power cooperation, institutions, the environment, development in the third world that is being neglected. And in that sense, I think the Bush administration has a view of the world that almost no one else shares. And that's one of the reasons that we are seeing the United States find itself in such isolation on the global landscape.
I guess you could argue, though, that this kind of unilateralism is just a trend, a short-term trend, a temporary aberration on the part of the Bush administration.
I don't think it is. There are many debates in Washington and in think tanks and universities around the country on this very question. That is this a passing phenomenon, a blip that will go away once President Bush is out of office and those people around him are no longer in power? I don't share that view. I think that what President Bush represents is a shift, a secular shift in American politics and American demographics that will push the U.S. towards both unilateralist and neo-isolationist impulses as time moves forward. And that is in part because the U.S. has a very long history of being both unilateralist and neo-isolationist. Indeed, from 1781, when we began life as a country, until Pearl Harbor, essentially, we were very diffident about engagement in the world. And when we did engage, we wanted to do it on our own terms. What put us into a centrist course towards institutions, towards permanent alliances, was World War II and the Soviet threat. And I believe that with that threat gone, we will not practice the same form of centrist moderate internationalism. And that's why I think we are seeing the country move toward the extremes of unilateralism for now. But I would not bet that the neo-isolationism that we saw during the first year of the Bush administration prior to September 11 Let's keep our powder dry. Let's pull out of the Balkans. Let's not broker the peace in the Middle East. That's for now silenced, but it is by no means gone in terms of our political culture and our politics.
Many policy analysts see the world dividing along cultural lines into the poor non-Western nations and the West, and that's what we're already seeing in the struggle against terrorism. It's an East-West divide, which is an ideological divide, exacerbated by the disparity, the growing disparity between richer nations and poorer nations. You disagree?
I do disagree in the sense that I think if you look back historically, there is much more trouble within civilizations than there is between them. There is much more conflict, animosity within the Muslim world than there is between the Muslim world and Judeo-Christian countries. And I think that's partly because countries that live alongside each other that happen to share a common civilization or a common religion or ethnicity often threaten each other, and that strategic issues, borders, access to water often trumps cultural issues when it comes to geopolitics. And I also think that the extent to which poverty is going to be the breeding ground of the new fault line, that is, angry, super-empowered, angry people will come after the United States, is vastly overblown in the sense that, unfortunately, most of the world that is poor is not of geopolitical consequence. And that's because, let's say, a country like Botswana, with a very high percentage of HIV in its population, may well disappear as a country if we don't do something about it. So I see this as a humanitarian emergency, perhaps of epic proportions, but we should deal with it precisely on those grounds, as a humanitarian emergency, and not see it as a strategic threat. And that's why I think we ought to pay attention to what has always bedeviled diplomacy and statesmen throughout history, and that is competition and rivalry between centers of power.
I'm talking with Charles Kupchan. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He teaches international relations at Georgetown University. He served on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration, and he's the author of a number of books on foreign policy. His new book is The End of the American Era. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Charles Kupchan. He served on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international relations at Georgetown University, and he has a new book about American foreign policy called The End of the American Era. Are there successes on the part of the EU's economic integration policies that make you think that Europe will surpass the U.S. As a superpower, even though Europe has such a small defense capability?
Well, right now we're at a Europe that has collectively about $8.5 trillion GDP. The United States is around 10 or a little bit past that. If you look at enlargement, you look at the potential for Europe to grow at a pace roughly equal to that of the United States, then you do see the two entities begin to pull even as this decade progresses. And I also think that the EU has certain distance to go in on the economic front, that if it loosens certain regulations, will in fact pick up growth, potentially produce growth that is beyond what the United States is experiencing. In one example would be, for example, the internet penetration rate. A lot of the startup money that was in the U.S. during the dot-com revolution left our shores when the bubble burst, and it's now in Europe. And so it may well be that the internet revolution, the sort that we had in the 90s, comes to Europe in this decade, increasing productivity and efficiency. And we also see a Europe that will, of necessity, begin to cope with some of the constraints on its economic growth, labor immobility, a state that is a little bit too interventionist in the economy. And once those changes go ahead, and yes, they will be slow, they will be difficult to get, but they will be forthcoming, I think you'll see European economic growth pick up.
Let's talk about oil. I think plenty of foreign policy analysts argue that the current administration's policy is driven by the politics of oil, our dependence on oil, and financial interest in controlling oil reserves and the oil markets. You don't spend an inordinate amount of time in your book on the oil factor. Why not?
Well, I think there's no question that oil plays a big role in our foreign policy, that one of the reasons that the U.S. has as many troops in the Persian Gulf as it does is to protect the flow of oil. It's central to the health of the industrialized world. I don't spend a lot of time dealing with it, in part because it is an issue that gets a lot of treatment elsewhere, but also because I think that right now the landscape is one in which access to oil is relatively assured because of our ties with the conservative regimes in the Persian Gulf, because of the gradual diffusion of our sources of supply. And to the extent that I do deal with this issue, I focus more on American consumption, because I think the real culprit here in terms of our dependence on oil is simply the U.S. consumes too much. We have 4% of the world's population, but consume 25% of the annual energy consumption. And in that sense, we are setting ourselves up for trouble. And I think our strategic policy on defending oil is reasonably good. Where we need to spend a lot more time is decreasing domestic consumption and looking for new sources.
You worked in the Clinton White House, and you know how a president interacts with foreign policy advisors. So what are your reactions as you watch how the Bush administration is developing its foreign policy, knowing what it's like to be in the White House and to hash out these decisions?
I find several aspects of the Bush team quite remarkable. The first is its discipline. I have never seen a White House so tight-fisted about information, so able to stay on message day after day, whether it's Rumsfeld speaking or whether it's Wolfowitz speaking or whether it's Condi Rice speaking. They really hum like a well-greased machine in ways that previous administrations did not. The other thing that I think is striking is how little we actually know. The press corps here in Washington complains regularly that no one is really disclosing how things work in the White House. The ambassadors that I communicate with occasionally say they can barely get their foot in the door. And I think that is part of this discipline. It's part of the plan of the Bush administration to keep tight reins, both over the formulation of policy, but also over public diplomacy. And it's clearly paid off. I think the midterm elections and the success of the Republicans were directly related to the message creation. As far as who seems to be running the show, I can only guess, because I don't think we have good information yet. But it looks like the central cleavages are between Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz on one side, Secretary of State Powell on the other side, who is more moderate, more committed to institutions. My sense is that Condi Rice is the person who arbitrates, and that the real power behind the scenes is Dick Cheney, the vice president. He seems to have not just the president's ear, but I think a relationship with each of these other players that puts him in a central position.
Do you see George W. Bush's personality or his personal experience actually driving policy? I'm thinking that other than trips maybe to Mexico from Texas, he's a man who had only been out of the country 3 times before he got to the White House. He has very little international experience.
I think he's a changed man. I think if you go back and watch his behavior and listen to what he said from January 20 to September 11, you saw someone who really was not that interested in an America that was out in all quarters of the globe running the show. he kept referring to an America that could not be everything for everybody. He wanted to focus on the Western Hemisphere. His first two meetings were with Chrétien, head of Canada, and Fox, the head of Mexico. His first state dinner was for Fox. His first summit was a summit of the Americas in Quebec. So the center of his world was North America and the Western Hemisphere. That all came to a screeching halt on September 11. Mexico has essentially been chagrined because they feel Bush has turned his back on them, and now it's terrorism 24/7. Whether Bush and the Republican Party stay that way is a separate matter, but I do think that that the president was profoundly changed by those events, and that he continues to keep terrorism as his guiding light and the basis not just for his foreign policy, but also for his building domestic support across the American public and on Capitol Hill.
You have great respect for the discipline that the Bush administration has been able to maintain its focus on foreign policy. I gather that wasn't your experience in the Clinton administration.
Well, the Clinton administration was just a little bit more loosey-goosey. People were talking to the press. There were frequent leaks. There were disagreements among players that sort of snuck their way out into the public. And in that sense, I think there was less sort of top-down order. There was less, it was run less like a corporation and more a little bit like kind of a bull session. Sitting around in the room and people throwing in their two cents. I am much more sympathetic with the policies that the Clinton administration pursued than I am with the Bush people. But in terms of the actual process, the way it functions on a day-to-day basis, I think the Bush people have put together a very impressive operation.
Charles Kupchan, thanks very much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Charles Kupchan is the author of The End of the American Era. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing nearly 3 million members with customer-focused financial strategies and service. Online at Thrivent.com, and by Harcourt, publisher of Life of Pi by Yann Martell, a modern-day adventure story. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writing for the hit BBC show Absolutely Fabulous, a talk with Ruby Wax. She has a new memoir. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews Joe and Zoot and More, the reissue of the 1973 recording of violinist Joe Venuti and saxophonist Zoot Sims. We're listening to it now.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. If this show were on the BBC, my guest Ruby Wax would need no introduction. She's a fixture on British television, despite the fact that she's not a Brit at all. She was born in Chicago. Wax has been a talk show host, a game show host, a writer and performer on sitcoms, and an interviewer of such celebrities as Imelda Marcos, Roseanne, Madonna, and Sarah Ferguson. Just to give you an idea of her style, during the Fergie segment, Wax rifled through the Duchess's lingerie drawer, looked for diet foods in her fridge, and in the end locked Fergie out of her own house. Wax was also the script editor for the cult hit series Absolutely Fabulous, starring Joanna Lumley as Patsy, a booze and drug-addled ex-model fashion editor, and Jennifer Saunders as Eddie, a hilariously self-involved publicist who jumps on every trend for all it's worth. Here's Eddie giving directions to her daft assistant, Bubble, played by Jane Horrocks, as she's about to leave on holiday for France.
You, remember, cancel my aromatherapy, my psychotherapy, my reflexology, my osteopath, my homeopath, my naturopath, my crystal reef, my shiatsu, my organic hairdresser, and see if I can be rebirthed next Thursday afternoon.
Consider it done.
Ruby Wax has a new memoir just published in the UK called Ruby Wax, How Do You Want Me? I asked how she got involved with AbFab.
I came on board much earlier than Absolutely Fabulous because I'd always been writing with Jennifer Saunders. So, I started right from the start, and it found Patsy, who was Joanna Lumley, as a kind of out-of-work actress in real life. She had like a real hit in this country. She was one of the girls in the Avengers and then had fallen on bad times. And I said, could she come on my show, which was an interview show? And we would film it in a documentary style of how bad her life had gone since her, you know, her heyday in the 60s. So I pretended to break in her house and find Joanna Lumley sort of snorting Ajax in the corner and living with some kitty litter and seriously shaking, drinking, and smoking with somebody in bed with her. And she was such a good actress that people thought this really happened to Joanna Lumley, and there were letters of complaints. And that swung into Patsy.
So you created this completely decadent, self-destructive...
But a riot, because, you know, it's our biggest fear of what we are.
So how did Edwina come into the picture? Was that a character that Jennifer Saunders developed?
Yeah, but it's based on a sort of a multitude of people we know in PR, who, especially one who I once sat in the back of her car, as she likes to be... Well, she was half Buddhist, half insane. So I watched her try and calm herself down as she sort of screamed at somebody on her mobile phone, screaming that she was going to kill her and take out her insides, and then suddenly put the hand over the phone and go, yum, yeho, ringekyo, yum, yeho, ringekyo, and then back to the phone again, and then yum, yeho, ringekyo. And so I told this to Jennifer, and so we created a character that was religiously based but a megalomaniac.
So what was your process? Did you and Jennifer Saunders write together? Did you get together
No, Jennifer Saunders writes a script brilliantly. And then I just put the, you know, sometimes I'll bump it up and write it. You know, if she's talking about models going up and down a runway, I would add, you know, they look like newborns. Why not just toss a fetus down a runway? So, you know, sometimes I'll just put the twist in it.
I'm thinking of something from your book that models look like a spinal cord in a dress.
Yeah, all that. That's how I write anyway. So we just pull those kind of lines.
One of my favorite episodes, Edwina goes to find herself at an ashram, and where you have to hold the talking stick to be permitted
to speak.
Yeah,
well, I did hold the talking stick. I went on one of these, journeys, which I kind of, you know, it did change me as a human being, where you did have to go into the mountains and smear yourself with mud and give up your most prized possession. So I gave up my mirror. And so sometimes I would relate to certain spiritual experiences, and of course there's great fodder for, well, you know, interesting things can happen, and also great fodder for comedy, because it's entertainment, and especially in this country they have no tolerance for anything kind of psychological or therapy, and they just adore, you know, just tearing it apart.
They adore send-ups,
you know. So we have menopause workshops where, you know, everybody just screams embrace the dryness, you know. They just love the horror of taking apart situations that in America they find quite holy. You know, a lot of times we just watch TV and write it. Where people show up on Oprah, you know, fresh from the operating room, saying the bad news is, you know, I have no more penis. The good news is I have 20 million viewers.
You became known in England for interviewing celebrities for British television. How did you get into the celebrity interview gig? What What interested you about fame?
I'm not that interested in fame. I started off doing documentaries that were kind of journeys that, for example, I went into Russia. So from that, they said, okay, now investigate celebrity, because in itself, I don't find it that interesting, but I love the nature of the disease called fame. And so it gives me an excuse to kind of voyeuristically meet these people and then say, how do you deal with this kind of almost eczema, you know, that grows on you? And I always look for the person who can deal with it well.
Well, you interviewed Roseanne, you interviewed Madonna, you interviewed O.J. Simpson.
Yeah. And O.J. is, you know, we're talking about, this is the highest octane of needing attention in the world. You know, that's such a fantastic mountain range to plummet through.
Yeah, apparently you drove around in a white van with him for most of
Nobody would let us in. We called a lot of restaurants and said, you know, I could we make a reservation for two? And they said, who is it exactly? And when we mentioned O.J., we got that Muzak so fast your head ripped out of your spinal column. So I actually got stuck in a van with O.J. for the date. And, you know, he's so nuts that he insisted on giving me tours of, we went to Judge, what was it, Ito's house?
Uh-huh.
Ito's house, where he screamed, can I say, asshole out the window, and then said, would I like to see where Nicole allegedly was murdered? And I said, listen, I'm just trying to get some lunch here. So inadvertently, this guy is saying, come on, peg me. And then, of course, at the end of the interview, just to really make my day, he pulled out a banana and tried to stab me.
You describe interviewing Madonna. And
that was a terrible interview.
Yeah, you couldn't crack her.
You know, when 35 people are around somebody just to bolster whatever their self-image is, it's really difficult. And the whole interview was an argument about who got what camera. Eventually, she got the wrong camera. I looked like I was 3 years old, and she looked like the surface of the moon.
You mean in terms of the best angle, best side?
There were two cameras. One obviously had gel on it, and she picked the wrong one. Anyway, there was no penetration, and I really don't just need somebody regurgitating whatever they want the public to hear. It's not my thing. You know, I'm not hard copy. I just want to get in a conversation that sounds human.
British television personality Ruby Wax. She has a new memoir, Ruby Wax, How Do You Want Me? We'll continue our conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with Ruby Wax. She has a new memoir of her career in television in Britain. Also, she's a comedian. She worked on the cult hit Ab Fab. And her new memoir is Ruby Wax, How Do You Want Me? You were born in the U.S. and you grew up in Chicago. How did you get to England?
I went to Berkeley, where I studied acting, and, you know, nobody knew how to teach acting. And I mean, not at that time. You know, you had to sort of imagine that you were getting smaller and smaller until you imploded. And then suddenly you had to go out and do Ophelia. And I remember I didn't know how to act, but I knew she was upset. So I stood there going, my dog is dead, my dog is dead, my dog is dead. And then proceeded to give the most nauseating performance, not to be outdone by the Hamlet, who could hardly speak English. To be or not to be, nobody knew what he was to be. Was he a train? Was he a giraffe? Was he, you know, a candy bar? Nobody knew what he was. And at the end of the performance, which was so appalling, my father was hiding behind a tree. He said, if I ever see you on stage, I'll murder you. And of course, then I was determined to be an actress.
Eventually, you ended up in London.
You were very
determined,
sad and very fat.
And you were determined to be accepted to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Yes, I was driven.
And you studied to audition as Juliet for 8 months.
I lived in a bedsit. And Barbara, you know those old Rita Tushinga movies where everybody's in black and white and they suddenly kill themselves at the end and have bad abortions? Mm. That's what I lived like. It was, you had to put 50p in your, you know, your coin meter, and you didn't get heat. You got flickering coals. It just flickered. And there were they didn't have showers in this country, so you had to kind of squat in your bathtub and hold a tube over your head and sort of straddle your hairdryer for any kind of a heat source. And it was very depressing. But I learned to be Juliet. And I lived off of Alpen because I was so depressed. So when I walked, I crunched.
Alpen is muesli.
Muesli.
All right,
but then I could hear I existed. So I showed up fat with my wimple on and did my audition for Juliet. And they were appalled.
Do you remember anything about your audition?
Yeah, I did My Dog Is Dead, My Dog Is Dead Again. And then...
What's with The Dog Is Dead, Dog Is Dead? You say
makes
that?
Makes you cry. It makes me cry. If I think my dog is dead, I cry. Barbara, you're not with me here.
I'm sorry. You were creating your space there as an actress.
I was doing my thing. I was getting into my emotional role. My dog is dead. If I say that to this day or sing any old camp songs, I can weep for you. Crumpled my face up. Started, said Ruby Wax, doing Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare, the Bard, and now I will begin. My dog is dead. My dog is dead. And then started with, in the speech, Juliet explains that she's going to bang out her brains with Tybalt's bone. It's right because she's gone that deranged. And Barbara, I'm appalled, but I brought a turkey leg because I didn't realize it was a metaphor. So when I did that bit, I hit myself over the head, and there was a silence that I still hear to this day. I thought, what a brilliant concept. Of course she banged out her brains. And I acted every line, like, the madness, and I was screaming, and then at the end, a man with a small goatee came in the room and said, you, we want you for callbacks. And I said, but you didn't mention me, and he said, no, I don't think so. No, it was...
So
was
you,
not for
you
me.
didn't get in.
But I
you
didn't get in.
Eventually went.
I said you must have made some mistake. He said no, we didn't.
You eventually though did get into the Royal Shakespeare Company, where you write that you became an RW resident wench. Now is that the equivalent of always playing the prostitute on TV crime dramas? You don't
exactly.
even get a name. There's just whore one and whore two and bag
well,
lady one.
I was
one,
whore
bag
one. Juliet was whore two, and we covered ourselves in so many pocks that we actually upstaged the main actors. Just scratching our pox in the back. So for the next, this is from my book, for the next 5 years, I played every slut, wench, and milkmaid, underpants on my head as a mop cap, squeezed into a corset that brought my navel up to my neck and my breasts so high I could wear them as earmuffs. Then I was up on the RSC stage speaking a kind of Elizabethan porno, holding my little Bo Peep stick going, oh, no, sir, you mustn't shaft me, kind sir. I'm just a simple buxom wench, I am. I may look it, but I'm not a slut. That was actually how I spoke. And then from there, I went on to play a whole range of non-speaking prostitutes, competing with another upstart tart, Juliet Stevenson. We tried to out-whore each other, spending hours in makeup to see which one of us could cover ourselves with the most pox. We had no lines, but we would improvise as whores in the back of the set, gossiping about who had what stuffed on their codpiece. And it started off with socks, and then it eventually ended up as watermelons.
Now... how far did you get acting? And I think some famous friend of yours said, you really should not
Alan
be
Rickman.
On the stage. I'm begging you, go.
Well, Alan Rickman Ian Charlson and Zoe Wanamaker used to look at me with horror. And, you know, so there's nothing like getting it from while you're on stage, realizing you can't actually do this. And so I said, well, what should I do? I whispered from my nymph outfit. And he said, because I was now playing a nymph, he said, start writing comedy. So
this is Alan Rickman recommended that you write comedy.
Pretty much while I was on stage, because, I mean, Michael Horden was in the show, too, and he would sometimes go, I'm so ashamed when I would perform. And there's nothing more mortifying than knowing you can't do it.
Right, nothing like the confidence of your,
ooh,
of
no,
your
no,
colleagues.
No.
You began...
So I wrote comedy with somebody and called it the Johnson Wax Floor Show, and we would go into her bedsit and invite Trevor Nunn and the Royal Shakespeare Company into her bedsit, charging them... a lot of money, come in with a blanket, drop it, and do our own shows, which turned out to be quite a hit.
So you began to write these comedy shows, and with the help from your friends from the theater, like Alan Rickman and Zoe Wanamaker and Jonathan Pryce, you staged the shows in your apartment, in your bedroom? What do people sit on the couches or on the bed?
Oh, they sat on the bed, and then we appeared on the floor. And eventually I let other people into my shows, Zoe Wanamaker, Jonathan Pryce, but they played smaller roles than myself. Because I was sick of being garbage bag number two and garbage bag.
They played wench number one. And
they
wench
were
number
wenches
two.
Now, and I was Prospero.
Now, your family life was really shadowed by your parents' histories. Both your parents are Jews who escaped Austria during World War II, and your father served some time in a Nazi labor camp. Did they tell you much about their war experience when you were a kid?
No, they never mentioned it. I mean, I only saw what happened when, you know, finally my parents had you know, both had strokes, and I went into the attic to, you know, kind of clean out the house, which is already a mortifying experience. And there were letters begging my parents to help them get out of Austria, you know, and I found the passports with the big J on it, and they never mentioned it while we were living together. And I used to say, Mom, did I have any relatives or whatever? And finally, in the last few years, she said, oh, yeah, but they were all burned. I don't know what happened. And that was like, and then going on and eating her bagel. It was never mentioned. So they lived, you know, as most people, I don't know, they wouldn't tell me what the facts were. And so they built up a kind of resentment that I came into a world and had a great time, and they were thrown out of their world in the kind of peak of their life.
You write that your father in particular, well, really both of them, criticized you mercilessly and were verbally abusive. Was your father physically abusive also?
You know, war was created in our kitchen because they were so angry again. It was such a dynamic time of people leaving oppression like that, and then you come into this kind of hippie world where, you know, everybody's having an orgy. And so they kind of created war in the kitchen, you know, and it was very physical. Everybody would kind of, you know, like in the cartoons, jump on each other and kind of, you know, it was ignitive in the house. It was hysterical. And my mother had a thing about cleaning. She couldn't stop with the sponge. You know, she'd walk around like Quasimodo, kind of with two sponges in each hand. You know, I got her a black one once for formal wear. I mean, it was obsessive behavior. And I guess they were trying to blank out, you know, what they'd left or how angry they were. And I thought, whatever I do, I don't want to grow into this.
Were either one of them funny?
Oh, man, my father was funny. He was vicious and he was funny. And my mother inadvertently, you know, would speak in this high kind of aria type of, run with the hyenas. This is insane. She's a bum and she's living in the slums of Chicago. These are criminals. She would talk about my friends and kind of fly at you in horizontal position when you were eating and wipe the sponge across your mouth, down across the plate, across the table, down the thing, wiping through the dog stuff, out the door, and you'd have to, like, bang her on the head to stop this woman with the water running all the time. And always, you know, when I'd get dressed at night, you know, she'd take those underpants away from me and iron them, either clean the gusset, and back in the drawer they went. You know, it was just they wanted to control everything because they had such a fear that I would be somehow polluted when I... So I used to escape out the window, and in a way I created the escape in a small, minuscule way that they kind of did from Europe. So I always say I escaped back into Europe when they escaped out of Europe.
So what are you doing now?
Well, luckily in this country, again, they don't peg you, so I have a daytime show, but I'm also doing Get Back to Six Big Celebrities,
Who?
From late night. Oh,
Who?
You know, Tom Hanks, Clinton, Ben Affleck, that world. It's a job. And then I'm going to do this book as a one-woman show.
Oh, Ruby Wax, thanks very much for talking today.
Thank you.
Ruby Wax's new memoir is Ruby Wax, How Do You Want Me? That's pianist Jackie Terrison from his CD, Ah, Paris. Coming up, a review of the jazz album Joe and Zoot and More. This is Fresh Air. Joe Venuti was born in 1903 and was the leading jazz violinist of the 1920s, when jazz was young. Saxophonist Zoot Sims was born around the time Venuti got established and came up playing the more modern styles of swing and bebop. Eventually, these two very different musicians came together to record in 1973. The album Joe and Zoot has just been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says they meshed like Velcro.
Joe Venuti, performing the seemingly impossible task of playing all four strings of his violin at once. He did it by taking apart his bow and sliding its back under the strings. Venuti always did go his own way. Violin had been part of many early New Orleans jazz bands, but just when the instrument was fading from the music, Venuti helped keep jazz fiddle alive. His clear and forceful style influenced a lot of later violinists. Still, in later years, Venuti wasn't working that much, until his proverbial triumphant comeback around the time he turned 70. That was in 1973, the year he recorded as part of a quintet with Zoot Sims on saxophone. Zoot Sims on tenor sax. He was 22 years younger than Joe Venuti, but a bit of a throwback himself. Sims grew up as part of his family's vaudeville act at a time when vaudeville was fast disappearing. He greatly admired Venuti and did his best to fit in with him. Sims usually played tenor, but on this session he mostly features his new toy, the smaller soprano sax. Where most soprano players then were inspired by the groundbreaking John Coltrane, Sims recalled its use back in the 1920s when Venuti was young. The unusual pairing of violin and soprano gave a distinctive cast to their 1973 session, reissued on the CD Joe and Zoot and More. This is I Found a New Baby, written in 1926. Thank you. Cliff Lehman on drums, backing up Joe Venuti on violin and Zoot Sims on soprano sax. I love how bright and natural that combination sounds. Much as Sims acknowledges the 1920s, he doesn't ignore what jazz had learned since then either. He's not playing straight Dixieland there, but then neither is Joe Venuti. The leaders played down their stylistic differences to celebrate the eternal qualities most all jazz musicians hold dear: an elegant line, a spirit of cooperation, and a forward thrust. The CD Joe and Zoot and More also draws on three other sessions Joe Venuti did in the early 70s, including duets with guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli and a quartet date with Spencer Clark on the rare bass saxophone. He doesn't swing like Zoot Sims, but it's another unusual color to complement a great fiddler who is still raring to go.
Music from the CD Joe and Zoot and More. Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by WorldCom. An update on management and policy is available at worldcom.com/update, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Parachute Infantry, an American paratrooper's memoir of D-Day and the fall of the Third Reich, by David Kenyon Webster, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Fred Rogers on remembering what it's like to be a child. That's what he did when he sat down to write his new book for parents. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that we're friends.